Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour says conventions don't matter. That has increasingly become the view of people who study elections. The week-long pageants may dominate news coverage and give party leaders and activists a chance to rally, but they don't seem to have much impact on voters. Recent conventions have done little to change the public opinion architecture of the race, and when they do move polls, the much sought-after bounce, it usually proves small and expensive. So if conventions don't change whether or how people vote, what does? Well, that's the subject of a very interesting book on the very subject. It's called The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. This turns out to be about a $6 billion industry in this country and is very, very sophisticated, and it's been studied, really. Our guest looks at the history of this for a long, long time. Sasha Eisenberg is our guest this hour. Sasha is a columnist for Slate and the Washington correspondent for Monocle. He covered the 2008 election as a national political correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's also written for New York, the New York Times Magazine, and his first book, The Sushi Economy, was published in 2007. Well, welcome phone calls for Sasha. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can use our Facebook page, too, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Sasha. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
I can't believe these techniques have been in existence. They are just so sophisticated, and people are going out on a whim. There's a whole backstory to elections that I don't think most of us know about.
Yeah, especially in the last decade, the sophistication of campaigns has increased greatly. And, you know, I think that one of the things is the media has sort of failed to keep up with this. And so I think if you read the paper, you watch the news every night, you'll see a lot of the campaign coverage basically sounds the same as it did in, like, 1988, talking about what the candidates said in their speeches that day and what their ads say. But there's a lot more going on behind the scenes now, and that's sort of the story I'm trying to tell, is how in the last decade campaigns have been sort of transformed by an influx of new data about voters at the individual level and sort of new tools coming in from behavioral psychology and from commercial marketing that are allowing campaigns to make much more sort of refined decisions about what they think who voters are, what they care about, and how they can be moved.
Yeah. Well, let's start with what you talk about early on in the book, and that's the some letters or emails that people have received that really plays on some social pressure, a sense of obligation of being doing the right thing, of not lying. What's the guy's name who put together this whole idea, and it really paid off?
Yeah, it's this guy, Mark Grebner, who's based in East Lansing, Michigan. He's a voter file consultant, which he was the first person in Michigan to go to every city and collect the voter registration records and put together a database that he could sell to candidates and parties. And he actually did the same in Wisconsin. It's the two states where he works. That data means a lot, especially in states like Wisconsin where there isn't party registration on the file. So knowing which primaries people voted in and their vote history is a matter of great, great value. And he had this idea in 2006 to send voters a copy of their own vote history. And so this is something that's, you know, publicly available. And he sent this letter that said, Dear Kathleen, as you may know, your voter history is a matter of public record on file at the County Board of Elections. Here's your vote history. And it said, you know, in 2010, you voted in the general election. You didn't vote in the primary. You didn't vote in the recall. You voted in a school board election. You didn't vote in the state Senate special election. And then here are your neighbor's vote histories. And he picked out a bunch of people on the same block and had whether or not they had voted in the last, like, eight elections. And it said, as you may know, there's another election coming up in a few weeks. After the election, we will send everybody an updated set of these vote histories. And it had the most significant impact on increasing people's likelihood of turning out of anything that's been tested in these randomized control experiments that people have been running in politics for the last decade. He got death threats afterwards because it was, people accused him of basically blackmail, bullying people into
yes.
voting by threatening to expose them to their neighbors. And slowly over the last few years, a lot of people in the political world, people in academia, political operatives have been sort of tinkering with this, trying to find a way to sort of exploit this psychological imperative that people have to want to be seen as good citizens, to want to be seen as doing the right thing and fitting in with what their neighbors are doing, but not have the backlash because no candidate wants to be sort of put the return address on a piece of mail that voters will see as blackmail. And so there's been this sort of amazing collaboration behind the scenes of people in politics, people in academia, trying to figure out how to do this. And one of the things that they've come up with is the idea of sending people a letter sort of preemptively thanking them for being a good citizen, which sort of lets them know they're being watched but feels positive and encouraging instead of threatening.
I can't remember what race it was. I like to vote, so I vote all the time. Only once, though, for every election. But for the first time, I don't know what election it was, but there was we got mail. We get so much mail these days. It's unbelievable. And it had all my neighbors on it and how often they had voted. Not who they voted for, but the fact that they had voted. My name wasn't on there for some reason, so I don't think they did a very thorough job. But there were a lot of people upset about that. How did you get access to this information? Shouldn't this be
right,
private, et cetera? Has that technique been widely used? And you said there were people upset about it. So they've refined that?
Yeah, and, you know, I was in Wisconsin before the recall, and there were a few examples that were popping up of people using this. And so, you know, they ran this experiment in Michigan. They found it had this tremendous impact. And it was published in a political science journal in 2006, which is, probably the coolest thing that's been published in a political science journal in a long time. And, you know, it was this sort of neat example of only very recently political scientists sort of getting out of their offices and running these experiments in the field where they try to actually see what moves voters. And people in the political world marveled at it. You know, we can increase turnout 8% by just sending people a piece of mail. That's a lot better than everything else we've been trying. But there was this huge fear of a backlash. So people have been experimenting with sort of ways of softening it, but also there are a lot of, there's a real difference between if you're a candidate or a party and you care about your reputation, you don't want to be associated with threatening voters. If you're a super PAC or, you know, sort of outside committee that's attached to a business group or a labor union and you have a name like, you know, Wisconsin's for Loving Wisconsin, you know, political action committee,
right,
maybe you will see this as a good way to drive people to the polls. And so, there have been a number of these examples popping up over the last few years of groups doing it in, you know, on their own and sometimes sort of tweaking the presentation in a way that doesn't necessarily line up with the original research. But it has this, people in Wisconsin in late May, early June, when these were coming out before the recall, sort of accused of being this dirty trick, as though it's like some crude, ominously just threatening people on a street corner. It actually has like the most impressive scholarly patrimony of any dirty trick in like American political history. It's been peer reviewed, is I guess what I'm saying. It's been sort of 5 years in the making trying to figure out how to do this right in a way that sort of noble political players feel comfortable putting their name on.
Let's talk about those behavioral scientists and how perhaps over history or recently they're looking at what our human vulnerabilities are and exploiting them. You write about this desire to fit in or not be seen as a liar. How do campaigns take those things that we want to do and don't want to do and get us to vote? Get us to vote.
Yeah, and I think we always have this idea that elections are won by changing people's opinions, and I think media coverage tends to sort of operate under this assumption. The way we talk about campaigns does, and I think more and more this sort of innovation and scientific research in the last decade has pointed to the idea that a large part of it is about changing people's behaviors, and most of those behaviors are like fundamentally social. And so this idea of social pressure is about how you are seen by your neighbors and whether you want your neighbors to, people don't, what's really interesting is I think that people don't know or intuitively feel the line between sort of what's public and what's private in voting. So, you know, we, your, your, your vote is private. You vote in a secret ballot. Nobody knows how you voted. But people can know if you vote, and people in politics always do. And if you never vote in elections, they never knock on your door or call you during dinner. If you vote in every election, campaigns see you as a likely voter and approach you accordingly. But I think very few people realize that that's a matter of public record that your neighbor could get to. And anybody can go down to the Dane County Board of Elections and get a list of who voted in the recall, who voted in the last gubernatorial election. It's not protected information. And
right.
So what these studies did was, I think, sort of play with people's expectations. I think people have the expectation that that's not something that they can sort of be judged by their peers on. And in fact, it is, if somebody wants to take the time to make the information meaningful. One of the other really interesting studies in the same vein is, for years, candidates have gone out and said, voter participation, turnout is really low. Only 54% of voting age adults voted in the last election. 38 million, unmarried women who could have voted stayed home. Don't be part of the problem. It's this very League of Women Voters. Don't be part of the problem. Don't be part of the bad people who don't vote. A behavioral psychologist ran an experiment in 2005, and he randomly assigned two versions of the same postcard to voters. One, they had the same set of underlying facts that were all accurate, and one took a piece of information which was, fewer than half the people voted in the last election, a very pessimistic take on turnout, and one said, more people voted in the last election than in any election in history, which, given population growth, is very often the case. And he randomly assigned them to two groups and had a control group. And it turned out that giving people the same set of facts but portraying voting as a popular activity makes people want to do it. And now, this is widely used, especially on the left. And my guess is that, voters in Wisconsin, assuming it's still a battleground state at the end of October, when canvassers for the Obama campaign come knock on their door, will hear something that makes it sound like turnout is going to be incredibly high, not warning people that turnout is going to be incredibly low if they don't participate, and it says join the crowd, basically do the right thing.
Yeah. Let's spend some time on the Obama campaign. It's covered toward the end of your book. When people say he had a really good ground game, boy, did he have a good ground game, and you detail what happened here. They were looking at, whether a sign at a bus stop that they could get 28 voters would be worth their while, and they discovered that it would be. It was down to the individual vote, almost, it appears.
Yeah, this is like a big shift that's happened in politics. I think the Obama campaign has just sort of mastered it on a technical level. But until about 2000, campaigns were sort of, when they thought about targeting the electorate, they had to think in terms of sort of traditional geographical boundaries, counties, precincts, districts, or really broad geographic categories like gender or age, things that are attached to your voter registration record. After 2000, people in politics began to integrate all the information that was being collected by commercial marketers for things like your credit rating or for, mail order catalogs trying to decide who to send to. And they merged with the information on your voter record. And so now they didn't just know your age and your gender and which county you lived in and which precinct you lived in, but they knew whether you had a hunting license, what your socioeconomic status was, what your education levels were, what magazines you subscribed to. And they were able to come up with these very refined individual-level predictions. And so instead of treating everybody on a block the same way, you could start to treat people separately from their neighbors. And what that allowed you to do was sort of disaggregate these large categories down. And what the Obama campaign did in a really sophisticated way was sort of build up, if they needed 100,000 votes in Ohio, they didn't have to be 100,000 votes that were all in the same part of Cleveland. They could pluck out 100,000 people scattered across 80 different counties and send them all the same mail or give them all the same phone calls. And one of the things that they did that was really amazing was that they mapped out basically geocoded where all of their targets of a certain category were and found cities where they could buy advertisements on individual bus lines,
yes,
and mapped where the bus lines went compared to where their targets were, in places where they saw that one of the data points that predicted Obama support was public transportation ridership. This was the case in Milwaukee, in fact. And so they went out and bought bus ads. And one of the senior people in the Obama campaign told me, I've been telling my clients, he's been a consultant in California, so I've been telling my clients for 30 years, don't waste your money on bus ads. That's a stupid, crude way to do political communication in the 21st century. And now it's come so far around that you can so intelligently target your bus ads if you have that sort of individual level data, because you're sort of drawing your own political geography that's not bound by the old lines.
Yeah. Let's go back to those conventions, because they're both fresh in our memories. Are you saying that we, as people in the press, make too much of those? We look too closely at the political bounce that they get. We analyze the speeches and whether or not they stirred our souls. That it's really not that at all, that 90% of it is what you've just been talking about as to who wins?
Well, I think that we almost always overestimate what campaigns call persuasion, which is sort of changing people's minds and winning them over, and we underestimate what they call turnout, which is mobilizing people who already support you but aren't certain to vote. And it's pretty easy to see in this election and in the last few, you look at the polls and they've been pretty consistent, you know, 48-46, 47-47, 48-45. In each of those, it means that more than 90% of people being polled have picked a candidate. 7-8% are say that they're undecided to a pollster. There are probably a few points of each of those on each side. There are soft Obama supporters or soft Romney supporters that could be convinced to defect. But even so, I don't know, maybe 14-15% of the electorate is actually susceptible to persuasion from a campaign now. And the other 85% are people whose behaviors can be influenced. And that's, you know, ultimately what we call the ground game, is sort of counting those votes, individually contacting them so that you can categorize who do we need to persuade and who do we need to mobilize, whose opinions do we need to change and whose behaviors do we need to change. And then before Election Day, actually getting to those people and reminding them and nudging them to get to the polls. That's the part of campaigns we don't cover. And I think we spend way too much time looking at the speeches that people give to talk to the, you know, that 12 or 13%, and don't spend enough time looking at the sort of tactics that they're using to influence the 85%. And conventions just end up being this sort of orgy of indulging our desire as journalists to be drama critics and like high school debate coaches. And in fact, we should be like acting more like, you know, FedEx delivery, you know, logistics chains analysts, because I think that's, you know, more votes are coming in a year like this out of figuring out which doors to knock on and how to take back the data that you get from that comes onto a clipboard of a canvasser at the door than, you know, what some senator said at 8 p.m. last Tuesday night in a hall in Charlotte. Mm.
Sasha wrote recently about how difficult it may be to get some of that data, and we'll center on Milwaukee for a moment and African-American votes in the city. Many of them have disappeared since 2008. We'll talk about that and how you get data from places that may be important to your vote, and it's hard to get that. What sophisticated techniques are there in that area? Our guest this hour is the author of The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, which has been released today. Sasha Eisenberg is our guest, columnist for Slate, Washington correspondent for Monocle. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Eisenberg, our guest here on the Ideas Network, and we welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Rick in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Rick.
I think this new technology is quite interesting, and it reminded me of something that I have noticed. I live in Milwaukee in a home that was purchased by my wife with her first husband, and when we got married, I of course moved in and I'm voting from that address, and So my wife has been voting from that address longer than I have. Yet I have noticed that the Republican Party sends me fundraising letters. And I politically am to the left of the Democratic Party. My wife has a Hispanic surname, of Mexican origin. She gets none of these mails. I have a German surname and a male first name, and I'm getting these mailings from, you know, like during the recall especially, certifying that I'm a Scott Walker backer. And I think it's very interesting, and I suspect very strongly that they are using some sort of an ethnicity filter program in their direct mail appeals. And I'm wondering if your guest has heard about the use of such software.
Sasha.
Yeah, so I've actually heard of Republican fundraising letters going to other folks I know who've tipped me off and sent me camera phone pictures saying, I can't believe I got this. Republicans are asking me for money because their politics sound comparable to yours. So, you know, the way typically people target is that they are getting hundreds or thousands of data points about you. So they have your information from your voter registration record, which has your name, which has your age, in some states your race, has your address. So then you could start to make some assumptions based on what the census says about your block or your tract. And then they know the sort of political orientation of the precinct you vote in. And then there are all these hundreds of variables that are coming from commercial data vendors. And some of those are really specific, like, you know, the magazines you subscribe to, things you fill out on warranty forms. If you check the box that says your average household income is between $50,000 and $75,000 when you get a warranty on your toaster, that probably is filtering back in some form or another into a campaign office. And then there are sort of ethnic and racial indicators, which often are a combination of name matches, last name and sometimes first name matches, and also information off of the census where people can often predict, because neighborhoods tend to be very homogeneous in the United States, the likelihood that between somebody's last name and where they live that they'll be of a certain race and ethnicity. And all of these variables, sometimes thousands of them, go into algorithms. And the campaigns create these statistical models that are predicting your behavior or opinions. And I sort of think of them as credit scores for politics. In the same way that credit rating agencies will take thousands of data points that they know about you, and then everything they know about other people, and run algorithms to predict your likelihood of paying off your loan on time, defaulting on your monthly payment, running up $700 a month in credit card charges. Campaigns will have statistical models that predict other behaviors that they're interested in, your likelihood of turning out to cast the ballot in November, your likelihood of supporting Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, your likelihood of being pro-choice, and often your likelihood of responding to a fundraising solicitation. And so it won't be that there's one variable probably that is, or two or three necessarily, that they're using to filter out people that they send fundraising letters to, but that a combination of variables interacting with one another are predicting a certain likelihood of you being responsive, because people who share at least some of your attributes have been responsive in the past. And you know, and that they're making a gamble that there's a good enough chance that you will respond to that. Direct mail fundraising still only has a response rate of 2 or 3% for prospecting, so they're missing their mark 97% of the time. And so I think the caller may have just been sort of one of the more egregious examples of somebody who ended up in that 97%. But campaigns are used to missing their mark. They just want to improve their ability to sort of play the averages.
Thank you, Rick, for the call. Matt in Milwaukee. Hi, Matt.
Hi, yes. I recently read the guest's article on the case of the missing African-American voter in the city of Milwaukee. And
yes.
I was wondering how that figure was generated of 160,000 missing African-American voters.
So this was a so there are names on the voter file, people who are registered, and Milwaukee is known, as is the case in a lot of places in the country, for having a not particularly good voter file, and so that means that there are duplicate names, people who move and remain registered at both addresses, people who are registered under two very similar names in different places, and so when they go through to remove names from the list, they don't catch that somebody is Jim in one place and James in the other. it's sort of widespread problem record keeping on voter files. And so I was writing about this group called the League of Young Voters that did a canvassing experiment before the recall in June, and they work in they were running an experiment across the 318 wards in Milwaukee, but focusing on sort of working class black voters. And they found that I forget what exactly what the number was, but 40%, I think, of the names that they had on voter records were attached to residences where the people clearly did not live. Either the home is abandoned, foreclosed, a current resident said that the person who was registered no longer lived there. And so that number of have disappeared is that the voter file records no longer match up to somebody who's actually alive and living at that address. The people might be living elsewhere in Milwaukee. They may be living elsewhere. It may be a really old record that nobody took off the book. Somebody moved 20 years ago, and the person is still registered there. And so that's the sort of origins of that calculation.
And you say it's a staggering figure in a battleground state where Democratic prospects rely, and this is very true, on turning out Milwaukee's urban population. So what are the Democrats doing about that?
Yeah, and so the issue isn't necessarily that the people don't exist. And the word
sure.
disappear was colorful. It's that they're not at the address where the Democratic Party or the Obama campaign or any number of the outside groups that are trying to turn out sort of an urban black population think they are. And that means that the things that campaigns do to reach voters individually, there's sort of two categories of political communication. There's media, which is what buying TV and radio ads, which tends to be incredibly untargeted because you have to buy, a whole metropolitan area at a time, or even a cable system. You're buying, thousands of people who can often be very different demographically in a single shot. And then there's what campaigns call voter contact, which is historically mail, phone calls, and door knocking, and now increasingly includes targeted web ads, where you can talk to an individual person, you know who you're talking to, and you know that you interacted with them. And the issue that this raises is that the ability of campaigns to do voter contact, which is how they tend to do get-out-the-vote operations, is really flawed if you're knocking on a door and the person doesn't live there. Or the person who does live there is not who you thought it was, and you
right.
end up mobilizing the wrong person.
Right.
And so that's there's going to be a huge aggressive canvas effort. I mean, what it convinced this group, the League of Young Voters, to do, and I think a lot of their allies in sort of progressive Wisconsin politics, is that they need to start working a lot earlier. And they can't just on October 25th start knocking on doors, encouraging people to vote the next week. They're going to have to start, and they already have, much earlier, making sure that they know who's living where, so that when October 25th comes around, their records, they're not just relying on what the city and county have provided them in terms of a list of voters.
And Reince Priebus, Republican head of the Republican Party, has said that the Republicans have also really been knocking on doors, and their canvassing efforts have been superb to date for this election.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the issue of just like data, both sides acknowledge that that in many places the public records are just horrible. They tend to blame different people. And the Democrats have more of a historic culture of canvassing, mostly because for two reasons. One is labor unions, in many cases, let their pay or let their workers go out and do canvassing and turnout work. And so there's sort of always been a reliable army of manpower for Democratic candidates that for which the right doesn't have anything analogous. Then the other reason, and I think we can sort of understand how this works, in Wisconsin, is that Democrats tend to be in denser areas. The fact that for, the last century, Democrats have been generally clustered in urban areas means that you can send door knockers out, and they're going to hit a lot more doors in a given hour than if you go to rural counties. And so it often hasn't been efficient for Republicans to develop a culture of in-person canvassing, because you can hit a lot more people with phone calls Even if the quality of the interaction is worse on the phone than in person, and there have now been a lot of these randomized control experiments that show that, the efficiencies make up for it. And so Democrats have you know, really developed a culture of this going back for a while, and the big volunteer participation in the Obama campaign, I think, is sort of helped along with all this new data that makes campaigns a lot smarter about knowing which source to knock on to reawaken the culture of in-person activity on the Democratic side.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. Jean in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
You are awesome. I just wanted to ask a quick question. I had heard probably on MSNBC that this, or CNN, that this election comes down to 10 counties in the whole country. I was wondering if you know anything about that, and is that, I guess we'll leave it there.
I don't think that this way of thinking about the election is, like, actually accords with the way campaigns think about the election. And so, I think that we like to use this shorthand of certain counties or certain big demographic clusters, but that's not what, the campaigns either in Chicago or Boston are doing. What they do is they start with they create vote goals. It's basically the first thing any campaign does. Sometimes, before they've rented an office and plugged in their first phone line. And they start with what they call a win number. And this is looking back at past elections, comparable elections, and coming up with a total number of raw votes that would sort of guarantee victory. And so, in a presidential campaign, it's a win number in enough states that allow you to sort of have an electoral map strategy. And if it's a statewide race or congressional race, it's what you need to win outright. And then campaigns look at where these votes are going to come from. How many of these votes are going to come from people who definitely support me because they're part of my base and are going to turn out regardless of what I do? That's one bucket. Then it's people that that are supporters of mine, but I need to mobilize because they're not certain voters. Then there are people who are pretty likely to vote, but I need to persuade either undecided voters or need to bring them over from my opponent. And then if those numbers are not adding up to enough to get to a win number, can I change the electorate through voter registration? And that's the basic math, is figuring out how many votes are in each of these categories. And the point of doing canvassing and phone calling and asking people who they support is to keep on refreshing these numbers on a daily, weekly basis to sort of direct strategy. And so campaigns are thinking about individual votes and adding them up in a way that they know that it doesn't matter whether a vote is in, Portage County or Milwaukee County or Dane County. They know a vote's a vote. They just want to know which type of interaction they need to have with that voter to get the result that they want. And so, there are obviously states matter given the Electoral College, and there are some counties where there are more persuadable voters, and there's some counties where campaigns have to do a lot more registration work. But it's not that your campaigns have a whole set of tools that they didn't have a decade ago to go find votes, outside of counties that are traditionally classified as swing counties.
Are you from Wisconsin? You really know this state.
No, but it's the most interesting political state in the country now. We're all Wisconsinites now. If I speak not only for myself, but like all my colleagues, I'm based in Washington, but I think people, not just because the sort of ideological, rhetorical stuff is at a high level and you have a kind of cast of really interesting characters coming out of Wisconsin, but like for tactical, technical stuff, it's a place that, especially in the last couple of years, both the national parties and unions and the outside groups in the business community have all used, partially because you've had like 9 elections this year, are using as a staging ground, a testing ground to look at new techniques, to try things out. And so it's been the closest thing. My book's called The Victory Lab. Wisconsin's the closest thing that there is to a physical laboratory right now in campaigns where innovators are putting money on the ground and actually having real elections in which to test things.
Yeah, we do have our share of them. I want to talk just a little bit before we go back to phone calls. And our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Sasha Eisenberg, author of The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, is our guest here on the Ideas Network. I want to just spend a few moments in history because your book is fascinating. You go way back to the 1920s in the University of Chicago with some interesting and early changing voter behavior studies that were done there, and also the streets of New Haven where a couple of, they were behavioral scientists who were running pioneering electioneering field experiments at Yale University. Can you spend a few moments talking about that and who really paved the way?
Yeah, you know, so there's this guy, Harold Gosnell, who was this young graduate student at the University of Chicago in the early 1920s who sort of stumbled into this really amazing question, which is not just what makes people vote, but why do some people vote and others don't? And he, you know, there's huge interest in the sort of progressive era in trying to figure out, you know, progressives wanted more people to participate in civic life, and voter participation, you know, I think was around 60% at the time, and the question was why 40% of people weren't participating, because the idea was, like, we could beat the urban machine politicians if only these new immigrants and working class people turned out to vote. And so he went out and did a survey and asked people why they didn't vote, and he got some interesting answers, including, like, women post-suffrage often did not believe that they had actually been granted the right to vote. And so women were saying that they didn't turn out to vote because they didn't think that they legally could. You had handicapped people who said, I can't leave my apartment and actually get out to vote. But then he wondered, what can we actually do to change – is there anything we can do to change people's behaviors? And he ran this experiment where he randomly assigned a piece of mail across the wards of Chicago, and it was a flyer that had like a cartoon of a slacker, and it basically said, don't be a slacker, vote. And he realized that by sending this, he could influence people who got – certain categories of people who got this flyer voted at a higher rate than people who didn't. And it was – as best I can tell, the first time that somebody had done a randomized control trial in the social sciences outside of psychology. And, you know, this is 30 years before they were being used to test pharmaceuticals. And over the course of the century, other fields started using randomized control trials because it was the best way to disentangle cause and effect. The only way to empirically say to attribute the impact of a treatment was to randomly assign it to some people and deny it to other people and look at the difference. And economics started using this to great effect. Other social sciences, political science didn't. And for most of the rest of the 20th century, political scientists analyzed data, polling, election returns, but never really went out in the field to see what can we do to measure and influence people's behaviors. And these two guys at Yale in 1998, Alan Gerber and Don Green, had sort of grown frustrated with the fact that a lot of their colleagues in political science were making these sort of building these very broad theoretical models about how Congress behaved and how the military behaved and how elections were won that seemed very detached from how real people lived. That they were based on this sort of rational choice idea that everybody acted like an economist all the time. And if you're an economist, it's hard to explain why people vote because you allocate a lot of costs learning about the candidates, actually going to the polls, waiting online, and the benefits are really small. You have like this infinitesimal chance that you will be the deciding vote in an election that maybe will have some possible impact on your quality of life. By the economic logic, like nobody should vote at all. And so they went out and they tried, let's see, if the reasons that other political scientists are given for explaining why some people vote and some people don't seems illogical to us, let's go out and see if we can change people's propensity to vote. And they went out in New Haven in 1998, and they created four groups with a get-out-the-vote reminder to three of them. One got it by mail, one got it by phone, one got it by a student knocking on their door with a reminder, and then there was a control group that didn't get anything. And it turned out that the phone call did nothing. The mail had a small but measurable impact on getting people to vote, and getting a visit by a canvasser had a significant caused a significant increase in turnout. And they came away from this having kind of proved nothing in their fights within the discipline, but it proved incredibly valuable for political consultants who all of a sudden said, hey, you know, people who were selling direct mail to candidates said, hey, my stuff works better than the guy who's selling you phone calls. And a lot of campaigns and parties and unions started saying, hey, we're for the first time, somebody basically audited the stuff we're spending money on. And it changed the way campaigns spend money, but also introduced this tool that you can go out and measure things in the real world the same way you would, you know, the same way you would test a new drug. And it's brought a sort of sense of empiricism and credibility to campaigns that didn't exist before them.
Interesting. Well, it also says, unless I'm getting this wrong, that the human-to-human contact, which is just kind of basic, is very important.
Yeah, and you know, and this comes back to what we were talking about social pressure before. Everything we have learned from all these experiments in the last decade suggests that one of the reasons people vote is, or a driving factor in the behavioral decision to vote is, it's fundamentally social. So people vote at a higher rate if they are not only if they're visited person to person by a canvasser than if they get a phone call. But they've done experiments where they randomly assign some people to get calls from a volunteer phone bank, and some people get calls from a paid call center with the same message, and the people who get called by a volunteer vote at a higher rate than people who get called by the paid call center. And they're not being, the voter on the other end isn't being told this is a volunteer, this is a paid call center. They're able to discern in the enthusiasm, the tone of voice, that it's a real person having a real personal interaction and not somebody who's being paid to call them, and it actually influences their behavior. And so we still haven't fundamentally answered the question of why do some people vote and some people don't, but we are realizing that some part of the difference has to do with whether, you know, a sense of social interaction is being triggered by all the events, not just when you, at the moment you cast a ballot, but beforehand and afterwards, and how you want to be seen. You know, they've done experiments where they send mail to people before the election, and if they say, dear voter, or you're the type of person who votes, people, apparently because their self-regard changes, it makes them more likely to vote.
That's why we get those little stickers, too, that say I voted. It makes you feel so proud,
right,
doesn't it? I always stick them right on there. I voted. Let's welcome more phone calls. I can't believe we haven't talked about TV ads yet, because that's where all the money is in this election. And we have to ask Sasha how important they are. At some point, somebody must have done a study saying this is what's crucial in an election, because an incredible amount of money is being spent there. Is that effective? 800-486-8655 is our number. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. The book, which is just out today, written by Sasha Eisenberg, is The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll get to TV ads, I promise. First, let's go to Joan in Williams Bay. Hi, Joan.
Oh, good morning, Sasha. I forget his last name, but
Eisenberg.
What?
Eisenberg.
Eisenberg. Mr. Eisenberg, wouldn't it help when you're discussing all these statistics and also the randomized studies to quickly define random study and also the margin of error, which can probably account for some mistakes in names or spellings and this and that, but would account for these possibilities that would interfere with the random study, and also what random means for your audience. Unless you're speaking to a college audience, I think that it would be a turnoff to listen to your program. But it's a very interesting subject.
Thank you. So, you know, a randomized experiment means that, this is the way that drug trials are run. So some people are chosen at random. Basically, it's equivalent of a number being picked out of a hat, although there's now computer software that randomly generates numbers. And in the case of both drug trials and these political experiments, it randomly picks a number that's associated with a voter's record. And if the design of an experiment is that some people are going to get a message by phone and some people are going to get the message by mail, there's always a control group that gets nothing. And in the same way that if some people get a polio vaccine and some people don't, you can see that if the people who got the vaccine get better at or have an improved condition at a higher rate, you can attribute it to the vaccine. And starting in the 1960s, this is how the Food and Drug Administration required. It used to be that you'd go into they do observational stuff. And then and the change, which is now sort of widely used in the sciences, is that by sort of systematically withholding treatment on a randomized basis, you can determine what actually is cause and effect. And so you don't have a really question of margin of error because it's not a poll. You're not trying to sample the bigger population. If 1,000 people get the mail, 1,000 people get the phone call, and 1,000 people get no contact, the difference is what it is. There's a measurement of statistical significance. And so there are experiments that where there is a difference between the groups, but researchers will say it was not statistically significant. It wasn't a meaningful it could be described by just sort of natural variation or noise between the groups. And the all the studies I've been citing today are things that have been done in the field with these randomized methods and have been shown to have statistical significance. So it's not sort of the idea is when you randomize, you're making sort of chance or luck work for you and not work against you.
I would imagine that a huge amount of the campaign money system is going for television ads, and we have yet to talk about those. How important are they in getting people to the polls, in swaying people, and why in the world are there so many of them?
There are so many of them, mostly because the sort of structure of the consulting industry makes it a very easy thing to do. Once you've made an ad, it's often a lot easier to just buy time for it than it is to enlist volunteers and open a field office and train staffers to direct the volunteers, for example. A lot of for over 30 years now, a lot of the sort of political communications game, political strategy game, has been run by people who come out of TV. And that's historically been where the most money is for a consultant. So promising consultants want to, we can take the example of David Axelrod, the sort of chief strategist for the president. He was a newspaper reporter. He did some version of what I did 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. He went into politics. He became a press secretary. And after that, he could have gone and done any number of things in politics. He could have become a field organizer. He could have become a pollster. But in the 80s, the real money was making TV ads. And so a lot of people like David Axelrod naturally gravitated to that. And when they're advising candidates, their favorite tool is TV ads. Now, what we know very little ultimately about what they do because they're very hard to measure and you can't isolate through a randomized experiment just giving individual people individual ads because everybody's getting the same TV waves. But there's this one experiment that Rick Perry's campaign did in 2006 where Perry's top political advisor, Dave Carney, brought in these four political scientists he called the eggheads and invited them to basically run these randomized experiments on everything the campaign was spending money on. And they randomly assigned ads of Perry's in the 18 different media markets in Texas. And so some cities were getting ads, some cities weren't getting ads. They were getting ads at different levels on different days, all randomly assigned. And then they were able to look at how Perry's poll numbers moved in each city. And because it was randomly assigned, they could compare the difference in how he was doing in each city to the influence of the ads. And what they found was that ads did change people's opinions. When they ran positive ads about Perry, their approval of Perry went up, and in the head-to-head horse race numbers, his number went up, but it burned off very quickly. And so after a few days, most of the impact of the ad was gone, and after a few weeks, opinion had reverted back to normal. And so it's the best experiment we have of testing this in the real world. And what it suggests is maybe, one reason that campaigns spend a lot of money, which is that if they don't keep up the same level of spending in a continuous way, they're afraid that they'll sort of lose the impact.
Hmm. Dick in South Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, this is David in South Milwaukee.
Oh, hi, David.
But I had two things real quick. Someone called earlier and said that they heard on TV that there was 10 or 12 counties that would end up determining the election. And the story read that after the election is done, everything's said and counted, it may turn out that there was 10 or 12 counties that turned the election to one side or the other. The other thing I wanted to hear about is someone had said, or I had heard, that all of the television ad time through the election has already been booked by campaigns. Is that true? Are there still ad spaces that are open?
We have about a minute left.
Yeah, this is more or less true. Basically, all the TV ad time, I mean, you could probably buy Nickelodeon or something, but places where people think that they can reach adults who vote in all the battleground markets is basically all gone. All of the web advertising inventory that can be well-targeted geographically or demographically in those areas is gone.
Wow.
You know, one of the really interesting stories, all this money that's rushing in, not just from campaigns, but from super PACs, means that if you were to give me $10 million at the end of October and say, spend this, it would be very hard through conventional political channels to find a way to spend the money. And it'll be interesting to see in November what that whether campaigns change their approach or whether they have money that goes unspent, which traditionally has been a sort of the biggest no-no in politics, to have money left in your bank account the day after the election.
Really? So that may explain why we get triplicates, or maybe we get 10 pieces of the same mail, or
right.
We get 20 phone calls.
Robocalls. Yeah, robocalls are the thing that the last one. The reason you get so many robocalls is that a campaign the last weekend that finds it has money often has nowhere left to spend it except for robocalls, which is why you get so many of them and they piss you off so much.
Yeah, Sasha, thank you. It was a great hour. I really enjoyed it. Sasha Eisenberg, the book is The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, just published today. He's a columnist for Slate and the Washington correspondent for Monocle. Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Thanks very much to both of them, and thanks everybody for all of your calls. It was a good couple hours, wasn't it? Learned a lot. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead, so please stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.